I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
We're back.
We're here.
We're back. It's you and I today, Brian. Jer is with us on this plane, on this earth, but he is not.
He's not with us.
He is no longer with us today, but still alive. He is. He's not feeling very well, but we are back for another great episode, and we are joined by our new friend, Alicia Smith. Alicia is the Executive Director of Dyslexia Canada and the past president of the International Dyslexia Association Ontario. Alicia is dyslexic. Alicia is dyslexic herself and the parent of a brilliant child with dyslexia. She brings a personal and passionate perspective to her advocacy work.
You know what's really funny?
So fascinating. I'm so interested to talk to you today, Alicia. Interrupt me, Brian.
It's funny that you stumbled over the word dyslexia, because before we started recording this morning, I was talking to Taylor and he said to me, isn't it funny how hard it is to spell the word dyslexia? Like, I did go,
there must be an easier way to spell this.
It's completely cruel. I agree. It's completely cruel that that's the word that is chosen for this. And, you know, as a dyslexic person, I'm an avid user of, you know, Grammarly. Like, Grammarly is a huge thing. Totally. And they send you that report every week, you know, yes, about your all your word choices and your most common errors. And every single week, my most common error is misspelling the word dyslexia.
they have a column and they're like, you've never spelled this word right.
Like, this and, one, and not only that, 1,000. I never sell it the same way twice. You know?
Yeah. Because how many, if you have like a 4 or like a 6 number code, there's like however many million different combinations. I guess that wouldn't be the same for words, but like there's probably a lot of ways that you can go about that. So I gave a very simple overview or a very simple introduction to you. Let us know, what have I inevitably missed in this introduction? Tell us about yourself, Alicia.
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for inviting me to chat with you today. I think your introduction pretty much sums up what it is that I do. I'm the executive director of Dyslexia Canada, and I am a person who has dyslexia myself. I got involved with dyslexia advocacy in general because, as a person with dyslexia, I knew I had dyslexia. I was identified as having dyslexia when I was in high school, but I was never even really equipped to know exactly what it was or how to advocate for myself or how to speak about it. And so it wasn't until my own child was identified that I really realized that there was this need for more public conversation, better awareness about what it actually is and what can be done to support people, mm-hmm, to sort of break the silence. So that's why I am doing what I do and why I'm so excited to talk to you today about it.
I'm really curious. I feel like this is one of those conversations where stigma is going to play a big part. I know like broadly and sort of vaguely what dyslexia is from the sort of like culturally in the zeitgeist, like how people refer to it. But I feel like oftentimes you'll hear people, you know, who are writing something down or typing something out and they make a spelling error and they're like, oh, I'm totally dyslexic. I can't spell anything right. When really they probably or might not have a diagnosis of actually being dyslexic, in the same way that, you know, somebody might say, oh, I'm totally OCD right now because they're they're cleaning their house and trying to be really neat about it. Is that, from your experience, is stigma a big part of the advocacy work that you do, trying to reduce that?
Yeah, definitely the stigma piece, and also clearing up a lot of misconceptions about what dyslexia is. So you were talking about the spelling piece there. That's actually pretty accurate in terms of one of the things that people with dyslexia struggle with is spelling, for sure. But a lot of the times in the sort of popular ideas of dyslexia, people think it's about flipping letters around or seeing letters move around the page or seeing things backwards or in reverse. So that is something that we're really trying to clear up, because that isn't what dyslexia is. It's really a difference in brain structure that makes it more difficult for people to learn how to read, write, and spell accurately and quickly. And that can really, really slow people down. But because of other popular ideas about reading in general, like there is an idea that all smart people learn to read really easily and that, you know, smart people can all spell things, you know, so there, this stigma comes in when you're a person who struggles with the learning to read and spell. It gets wrapped up with ideas about your intelligence and how you see yourself, which aren't accurate at all. Like individuals with dyslexia are, you know, every bit as smart as everyone else. There's no link between dyslexia and intelligence. So there are lots of very, very intelligent people who have horrendous spelling, like I do, and who struggled with learning to read when they were little. But because that hasn't been discussed very much, there really truly is this stigma, and it impacts, you know, those of us with dyslexia. Like there's a huge amount of shame that, I mean, I still feel as an adult when I have to go and, you know, write something on the fly, like fill out a, you know, a congratulations card to somebody or something like that. You know, I know it's going to look like it was written by a toddler. And it's really hard to shake that. Mm. And there's also that stigma and that shame really helps people prevents people from asking for the help that they need or the help that their kids could benefit from that could really make their lives so much better. So that's why I think it's really important to have these conversations and clear some of that stuff up.
When you, you said that you learned that you had a diagnosis of dyslexia in high school, and so, you know, obviously I'm making an assumption here, but I'm making the assumption that dyslexia is something that is sort of inherent within you from that sort of shows itself as you begin to start to learn to read and write and those things. But high school is obviously well beyond that point. So what were the things that up and from the kind of like your early days of going to school and reading and writing and all that stuff to the point where you got diagnosed, you know, was there something, were you like, I know I don't read and write like other people. I know that there's something that I have difficulty with. Or was it like a total surprise and it was a huge revelation for you?
I would say that I managed to fly under the radar when I was younger. Things were definitely harder for me and I didn't really understand why they were hard, right? So it was very frustrating, like I had a lot of frustration in early elementary school. But I also worked really hard. So like with dyslexia, learning to read is harder, but it doesn't mean that you can't read, right? It just means that reading is going to take longer, writing takes longer, all of those things. So I did work very hard and I had to put in so much more work to get the grades than other kids. That was really frustrating, especially since I felt like I was smart and that I understood things, but I couldn't understand why it took me so long. So it wasn't until high school that that was explained to me, that I, you know, had some testing done and that sort of thing. But at the same time, it wasn't a huge relief because they didn't really explain to me what dyslexia was. They just sort of said, well, this is what's going on. And what we're going to do is we're just going to give you extra time. That's it. There was nothing beyond that for me at that point. But I think a lot of kids really do sort of cope well and fly under the radar. But a lot really don't and are really struggling. And it's really unfortunate because it shouldn't be happening. Like we can actually screen children now. And, you know, when I was a little kid in the 80s, we didn't necessarily have the screening tools we do now, but we've had screening tools for over 20 years where we could actually look at the pre-reading skills of children when they're in, you know, pre-kindergarten, kindergarten, and look at the early markers and warning signs that are indicative that, you know, these kids are at risk for dyslexia. It's not a diagnosis, but it's a flag of risk. You know, and if we do that, then we can get in there when they're in kindergarten and we can provide them with additional support so they don't have to struggle and be frustrated the way that I was.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say that was the most frustrating part for me with my son, was discovering that that was the case. So, you know, I knew what my experience was. I knew that I felt like if it had been identified earlier, it would have been better. But when he started school, even though he's only 15 now, but, you know, he started school in, I don't even know what year he started school in, but when he did, you know, I identified to the teachers that, you know, I wasn't identified with dyslexia until I was in high school. I know it's hereditary. You know, I think that, you know, please take extra care and check out what's going on with him. And then we started noticing that there were challenges, but we kept getting told essentially, well, we can't do any testing until he's in grade three. We can't really do anything to do extra support until he's had this period of time basically to fail first. I didn't know as a dyslexic person that that wasn't true. So that was what really, when I finally, my son got to grade three and we got the testing done and sure enough, he's dyslexic. And then I started to learn about, you know, these early screening tools that have existed for over 20 years and the possibility that that has. That's what really turned me into an advocate, because the impact on kids as they're struggling is just horrendous.
Mm-hmm. What are the what are some of those markers? Because I have a daughter who's just a little older than a year and a half, and
she can't read yet,
and she can't read yet, which is really frustrating for me. I was looking up last night, like, what are some of the signs and things that I should be looking for to know when she is seeming like she's ready to be potty trained. And I was looking at some of these signs and I was like, man, some of these are hard to pick out.
Like what? Can you give an example?
One of them was like that. What was one of them that was really hard? There was five of them, and two of them I was like, I think I see those pretty clearly. And then there was two or three of them that I was like, man, I have no idea if that's it. Cause it sort of pertained to things that I was like, she can't even do those things yet. She can't even do the expression thing that you're telling me I need to look for.
Like
in order
juggle
to know.
Three balls in the air right. at the same
right.
time.
Right. But I think there's so many things within kids that it's really hard, especially if it's your first child, to be able to know like what is like normal development in quotations, or like whatever those milestones are, and like what are the variations, or like what's a standard deviation one way or the other. I have no idea, and some of those things are just really hard as a parent to pick out. I'm assuming these screening things, though, they happen with, would it be something that a parent is looking for? Or would it be something that, you know, you would go to a professional, or would happen in like a clinical setting?
So the those are all really good questions. So I guess I'll answer them in order. So the first one around the early warning signs and like the things to look for as a parent, right? So we actually, at the Dyslexia Canada website, we have a list of things that parents can look for. And we also have checklists for parents that we, at different ages, like here are some things that you can look for. Those are actually like printed checklists that we send those out to schools and libraries and doctor's offices across Canada to hand out to parents to kind of look at. But some of the big ones to sort of look for in a young child, like preschool age child, are really around use of language. So one thing is that individuals with dyslexia often really have a difficulty in accurately hearing the different sounds in words. So again, people think dyslexia is visual, and it's actually more linked to auditory processing and that sort of thing. You need to be able to accurately hear all of the individual sounds in a word if you're going to be able to map those sounds onto letters so that you can read it or spell it. So in the case of my son, for example, there were lots of things that he said that I thought were really cute, but were actually kind of warning signs of that there was something going on, right?
That's exactly what I mean. I'm like, what's cute and what's something that I should be like, oh, that's a sign.
Yeah. So like he would say the word pretzel instead of pretzel. Like he thought there was an N sound in the word pretzel, right? Crayons. He would always call them crowns, which we thought were, again, very cute, but he wasn't hearing those sounds, even with correction, that sort of thing. He had some difficulties with pronunciation, which, you know, could be a speech issue, but it could also end up being indicative of dyslexia happening. So those are sort of like pre-reading type warning signs. Also really a difficulty with playing with language. So like rhyming. So a lot of, you know, little kids' games are rhyming games. You might play, you know, a game. And that was a concept that it was very difficult for him to wrap his head around. And that, again, is indicative of kids with dyslexia, is a difficulty with rhyming. Hearing the beginning sounds, like if you were to play a game with your child where you're like, I'm going to say a word, and then you're going to say another word that starts with the same first sound. Like I say, like, pink, and then you're expecting the kid might say rink or something like that. Or sorry, that would be rhyming, or something else that starts with pink, pop, you know, and they couldn't quite peel off that first sound and come up with an accurate word for you. Those are sort of the early ones. And then as kids are getting a little bit older in sort of the kindergarten age, it's really around difficulties with learning the alphabet, right? So if they're having an extreme difficulty with remembering the different letters, and being able to accurately identify them, learning how to print them, all of those things, like that is, again, an early warning sign. And then in terms of the screening, how that works, that's actually something that can be done in school by a classroom teacher. It doesn't need to be done in a clinical setting. It's the sort of thing parents could look into it, but it'd be really better to be done at school by a teacher. So one of the things that we're advocating for at Dyslexia Canada is for provincial governments across the country to implement mandatory universal screening for kids from kindergarten to grade two, so that we can get that done. So there's been a bit of movement on that, which is exciting. Ontario is going to be implementing mandatory screening next year. This year, they're training all the teachers, or school boards have been provided funding to train teachers. Some of them are doing it. Some of them are not yet doing it, but that's happening. Alberta has put in place universal screening as well. And we're working on convincing the rest of the provinces to do the same.
I'm curious now, like, to go back to your early experience and contrast that with what's being done now. In the case where you're able to detect that somebody may have dyslexia, you screen them and they screen positive for it. What sort of supports are there now that there weren't when you were in high school?
Actually, it's a little bit the opposite, to be totally true. Like, I feel like my experience of learning to read was actually a little bit easier than that for my son, just because of the approach to teaching reading in school. So I'm old enough that when I went to elementary school, it was in the early 80s, we'll say, that they were still teaching, explicitly teaching kids things like spelling lessons. They were explicitly teaching how to sound out words using phonics skills and things like that. So that was my base layer that I was getting. I was getting an extra dose of that kind of stuff at home from my mom. Whereas when my son started school in Ontario, and things have changed in Ontario, but not everywhere, the general approach to teaching kids to read was not that. It was based on a different approach to teaching kids to read that started from the whole language movement. And so there wasn't as much of an emphasis on teaching kids how to break apart words, how to identify the individual sounds, how to map those sounds onto letters. They had taken out explicit instruction in printing and writing and that sort of thing. So I might have thought it was boring when I was a child that I, you know, had to sit there and like learn how to write the letter A over and over and over again. But doing that was actually really helpful, right? So because of that, the struggles and the experience that I had, I don't think were as extreme. I know they weren't. It wasn't as extreme as the struggles and the difficulties that my son had.
That movement, was it? I think I've heard something about this. I'm not sure if this is right, but
yeah,
was it like a move from like phonics of sounding things out and learning the spellings to like pattern recognition or something like that?
Yeah. So it it's called balanced literacy now. It comes out of this idea of whole language. But what it was is the idea that skilled readers, when they're reading, aren't actually looking at all of the letters in the word, that instead what they're doing is they're predicting what word comes next based on the context,
like AI.
Based on the context, the syntax, or maybe a sampling of the letters, just looking at the first letter or the last letter. Mm-hmm. So that's an idea that was first floated in the 1960s. And it took a while before it really took off in education, but it was sort of the late 80s, 90s that it really took over in education in a big way. The problem is that that's not actually how people read. Like it was a theory. It sounded nice. It came out. It was studied quite thoroughly in the 90s as it was becoming popular in schools. So they, you know, put it into schools before actually proving it. When they went to do the research, they found out that it's not how kids learn to read. But once you release something like that into the world, it's really hard to walk it back, right? So we've been trying to walk it back for 30 years now, and it's been a disaster, like a complete and unmitigated disaster on the reading achievement for kids, like not just in Canada, but in the English speaking world.
I can imagine. Do you guys remember Hooked on Phonics?
Yeah.
Man, I loved Hooked on Phonics.
Yeah, it was awesome.
It's actually blowing my mind, because when you kind of explained that, when you were explaining what that theory is, I was like, yeah, I guess maybe I do some of that. But then at the same time, I read quite slowly, but I read a lot, and like reading and writing is like a strong suit of mine. And then I was thinking about Hooked on Phonics, and I was like, huh, it's so interesting, because I find that sounds like a really hard, it sounds like a really hard idea to convey to children, that is the way that your brain is intaking information. I mean, I feel like that would be kind of hard for a fairly large swath of adults.
You mean balanced literacy? This idea of
to convey the idea that you are that your brain is like filling in the spaces between words, and you know you're basically filling in words based on like a selection of letters in the word.
You know what's funny is I have ADHD, and I feel like that is more how my brain works. I don't know if that would have been more beneficial as a kid and learning, but I know that there are ADHD reader tools that bold the first two letters of each word, and it can greatly increase your the speed at which you can read. But I don't know that it increases my level of comprehension.
Mm. Yeah, it's very interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. And the way that they use it as an instructional approach for teaching kids is also kind of like caught up in this idea that learning to read is something that happens naturally, like just through the act of reading. Mm. So we don't need to explicitly teach kids things like how letters and sounds relate to each other. Mm-hmm. And so the way that works in the classroom is that reading instruction for the last 20 years or so has really been based around these sets of books that are set up in a way that that kids can read them independently without really reading or without really being readers. And then they sort of take away those scaffolds over time. So the beginning books are super repetitive, right? So I don't know if you guys, you did say you have a kid, but I don't know if you've seen these little books, because this was new to me when my child started school. But it would be like the first book would be like at the zoo, you know, I see a monkey, and there'd just be a picture of a monkey on the page, and that's it. I see a giraffe, and there's just a picture of a giraffe. And that's the whole book, right? So you go through the book first with the kid, and you tell them the pattern, I see a, and then they guess based on the picture, right? And they just work their way through the book, and they feel like they're readers. And the idea is that by doing this over time, that the kids will either memorize the words that are there, or that they'll tease those words apart, and they will come up with their own sort of understanding of how the S in the word C, you know, represents this sound, and the double E is a long E, like that they're supposed to tease that apart on their own, as opposed to the phonics approach where we start with the sounds and the letters and we show them how those work and glue them together to make words. And then, so it's like a top-down approach as opposed to a bottom-up approach. And it's, you know, very, very, very confusing for a lot of kids. They really never do come up with their own set of understanding of how spelling works.
I can imagine the last word in that book is, I see a xylophone.
So you're like, oh my, well,
it's good that we're not trying to sound this out.
It's like, it's very interesting. Like, it reminds me of, this is sort of, this is only at best adjacent to the topic of our conversation, but it does have to do with reading. When my wife was pregnant with our first daughter, she was reading a book called, I think it was called Growing Up Bebe, I think it was what it was called. It was an American woman who moved to Paris in her 20s, ended up staying there, living there, had a child there. And it was like this contrast of child rearing in North America versus child rearing in her experience in France. And there was like a lot of interesting tidbits out of there. And one of them was the sort of like race to the in North America, this like race to teach your children things younger and younger and younger. It was like, you know, math and reading in particular, like the, you know, if we just teach them these things younger and younger and younger bit by bit, then they'll get smarter faster and faster and faster. And, you know, we'll just have this like, you know, army of, you know, economic machines to, you know, to churn out whatever. And it was like, well, actually what ends up happening is when you teach a child something like reading before they're ready to start learning, they become so frustrated internally with the fact that they can't do it because they're not ready, that they ultimately end up learning to read at a much slower pace and much later than they otherwise most likely would have, because their association with reading is that they hate it, because their association is automatically that they can't do it. And it slows down development in children for things like reading and math in particular, I think it was. So it just struck me as on the reading thing, it's just something like really interesting about the way in which we think about kids and teaching them things. That whole top-down approach versus bottom-up approach and how you teach children. I have a year and a half-year-old, so I'm like very interested in all of this stuff, and I'm kind of like a sponge when it comes to trying to figure out what are the ways in which, you know, are most beneficial for my kid to kind of like come into the world and learn things. This has already been like, this is just a personal benefit to me, this whole thing so far.
I wanted to quickly come back to the point about the supports that are in place now, or at least what could be beneficial to someone who is screened and caught early, knowing that screening is a focus right now. What are some of the supports that could be in place?
Sure. So, I mean, I think the first thing that could be in place, and again, this is our mission at Dyslexia Canada, is getting these things into place, is that the schools actually provide reading instruction that aligns with what we know about how children learn, right? So getting down to that, you know, back to what you were saying about, are the kids developmentally ready? You know, there's a lot that we know about what is appropriate for kids in kindergarten. And a lot of it is making sure that they have those foundational skills in place. So things like being able to hear the sounds and words, you know, so that's a piece that can be taught. You know, you can do instruction and you can also do intervention for the kids that are really struggling with that. Making sure that they really know their alphabet before we give them books and expect them to read entire books. Like, let's just make sure they know their alphabet. You know, that's a good place to start too. So in terms of what could be in place, the first thing could be that classroom instruction, making sure that we're actually using evidence-based approaches that are developmentally appropriate for all of the kids right across the board. And then for those kids that are identified through screening as being at risk for having difficulty. And I should clarify too, it's not just a risk of difficulty due to dyslexia, but those screeners actually catch kids that are at risk of having difficulties with literacy for other reasons, right? All of those kids need to have intervention early for whatever it is that they are at risk for. You know, there are interventions that can be put in place to help them so that they can stay on track with their peers so that they don't end up falling behind and getting really frustrated. So that's really what could and should be happening in that preventative piece for little kids. Mm-hmm. But for older kids, like we have an entire generation of students that didn't get that foundational instruction, really struggled with reading, and many of them have just been pushed through the system all the way along. Like it is not uncommon for me to talk to high school teachers that have students in grade 9 that are reading at a grade 3 level, for example, and there are intervention programs that those kids should have access to as well. Unfortunately, most places, they don't have access to them through the education system. So making those programs available is really one of our big missions as well.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now, what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
It sounds so challenging to... Because like the basis of our education is like basically built on the ability to read and write. And, you know, I personally struggled with that in when I made the transition from going to university. I just found that like all of a sudden there was a lot of reading that had to be done on your own time. And as someone who was undiagnosed at the time with ADHD, like finding being able to prioritize that time to sit down and read was really challenging for me, and then not knowing that information going into class and struggling because I wasn't able to do the task. I feel like I have an appreciation for how hard school can be when you're not able to do that. Mm-hmm. Like how can the system, because it seems like that is such a systemic problem. I don't want to say problem necessarily. I mean, it's certainly a problem for these people, but how do we accommodate this large portion of people who might be struggling with these things?
It is a systemic problem. Like I think problem is the right word, and it expands beyond students with dyslexia. Just the general approach that we have to teaching people to be literate and the skills that they need so that they can read at the university level and keep up. Like we're just not doing a very good job of it. We've got multiple sources of data that show that across Canada, currently we've got about a third of students who are 15 years old in grade 11 that haven't yet reached the level of literacy that they need, according to Statistics Canada, to be successful in post-secondary or to participate in the, you know, fully participate in the modern economy is the term they use. That's a third. That is huge. So yes, it is a systemic issue. And that's why we've been addressing this as a human rights issue, right? Because as you said before, like everything in education is based on your ability to read and write. Like that is how you learn across subjects. And that's the skill that you need so that you can be successful in university. So Dyslexia Canada has worked with parents in 3 provinces now to bring these issues forward to human rights commissions. And we've had, 1 full public inquiry and 2 systemic inquiries that have been launched. So the biggest one was in Ontario, excuse me, where in 2019, the Ontario Human Rights Commission launched a full public inquiry looking at what the province was doing in terms of teaching all kids to read, how they were assessing kids' ability to read, what they were providing in terms of intervention and accommodations and things like that in education. And the conclusion of that was, it was stark. They concluded that Ontario is systematically failing kids with reading disabilities and many other students. So the only solution is full on system change is what the solution is, including a real overhaul of teacher education and teacher training, because that was what I experienced. I was hugely surprised. But this is also what the Human Rights Commission found. They audited all of the faculties of education in Ontario and looked at what are teachers being taught about how reading actually works, like the science of reading, what we understand about reading development, developmental milestones, all those things. And they discovered that teachers are not being provided with the actual accurate, up-to-date information. They're still being trained to believe that reading develops as that person from 1967 said it did, that it's something that develops naturally when kids are ready, and that, you know, people predict words based on cues and context and all of these other sorts of things. And, you know, as a parent, bringing my child into the education system, like, my kids had amazing teachers. Like, they were wonderful human beings who I could tell were working really, really hard. They really liked my son because he's a charming little fellow. And so they were working extra hard trying to help him. And you just trust that they're the experts. They know what they're doing, and they've, you know, they've been prepared to do this. Like, I'm dyslexic myself. Like, I can barely spell. How am I, like, who am I to say how they should be teaching my child to read, right? So to discover the huge gap in that knowledge, that, like, you know, that this information has been out there for literally decades, but it has never been a part of teacher training. It is not, you know, what they know. And they've been actively telling parents and doing things that are counterproductive for kids. Like, that was the biggest and most eye-opening piece to me. So the systemic change that has to happen really has to start with that, with teacher education, and you know, really looking at what's happening in those faculties of education and why.
It's really interesting too, because it feels like such a loss for society to not acknowledge that shortcoming, in the sense that, like, you said something right at the very beginning that it really stood out to me, which is, it's not your ability to read and write is not a metric of how intelligent you are. We can, you know, we can test people on their reading comprehension and their ability to write. And, you know, we could say that somebody who does a really great job at that and communicates really well through that medium is intelligent, but that doesn't mean that that is the only type of intelligence. And it makes me think of, I'll butcher this, but that, the picture of, like, a fish trying to climb a ladder or whatever. And it's like, if we judged a fish by its ability to climb a tree, it would live its life thinking that it was dumb or something like that.
That's pretty accurate. Yeah, you know. Yeah.
And I've felt like I've felt a bit of that way with ADHD, in the sense that there are things that I really struggle with. And, you know, when teachers criticize you for not performing well in those areas, then you sort of internalize that and think that that means that you're not smart. But that's not the reality. The reality is that there are lots of, you know, brilliant different ways that our brains work, and it seems really frustrating and like a massive oversight that this is not being acknowledged.
To that point, and I'm interested in what you think about this, Alicia. I feel like over the years, and this is fully anecdotal, but you just start to see lots of creative people being like, I'm dyslexic. It seems to me like creative people that we kind of put in that box of artistic creative, there seems to be a high prevalence of dyslexia. Does that feel correct to you, or is that just totally anecdotal? And if possibly true, would that be a result of, you know, that people are not getting the training or the education or learning, you know, to participate, in quotations, in what the Statistics Canada calls the modern economy machine, of which I am a proponent of, and so they are therefore by default sort of like pushed towards, maybe like more non-traditional career choices or things like that steer them in maybe more of a creative direction, where post-secondary education is not as held as such a crucial thing to have.
Yeah, it's really hard to say, to be totally honest. Like, I definitely have seen that trend as well in recent years, as we've been successful in getting people to start talking about dyslexia and start to break the silence a bit. I am seeing lots of, as you say, creative people, lots of entrepreneurs, lots of people in non-traditional careers coming forward and, you know, talking about their dyslexia, which is amazing. And I'm very glad to see that. I'm not sure if that is because there is a higher prevalence in those careers, which it might be true, like your theory there. Like I've never seen statistical evidence to argue for or against. No data. It could also be because people who are in traditional careers are still afraid to speak out, right? Like that's the other thing. Talking to a number of people who do work in large corporations who have those sort of like, you know, traditional jobs, they still are under a lot of fear or still experience a lot of fear of disclosing because, you know, they're trying to climb the ladder within an organization where you've got somebody else and their ideas and opinions. Whereas if you're in a creative profession or if you're an entrepreneur, you know, it doesn't impact you in the same way in terms of you're not trying to climb somebody else's career ladder. So I'm not 100% sure where I fall down on that one. And that idea of like, you know, the successful dyslexic as well, like there's lots, you know, like there are lots of intelligent and successful dyslexic people. And I like to encourage all of them to talk and share. But there's also a lot that's unknown about the individuals with dyslexia who never received support or didn't have those additional protective factors of very high intelligence that helped them to cope, right, and to move forward. So another like very troubling statistic is around the prevalence of low literacy in prisons, right? Like this is one we don't talk about as much. But the Canadian Association of Chiefs of Police did a study a few years ago, and they found that 65% of incarcerated people in Canada had less than a grade 8 level of literacy, right? And we know that dyslexia is the most common cause of reading difficulties. So there's a pretty good chance that a lot of the people there are dyslexic as well. But because there hasn't been a national program where we're really screening kids and identifying everybody, it's really difficult to have any sense of accurately where it's shaking out.
Mm-hmm. Is one of the hopes in screening to be able to provide that data and say, and to be able to like actually point to it and go, this is as big of a problem as we know it to be, and possibly even bigger?
I think we already have the data to show that it's a huge problem. The big hope with screening is really to get support for kids when they're little, right? It's more about that individual support and also making sure that at a system level that we're exposing problems in the system, right? So especially when you're screening kids that are in grade 1 or grade 2, you know, the screening isn't a one and done kind of screening test. It actually happens multiple times per year. Like ideally you'd be screening kids at the beginning of the year, the middle of the year, and the end of the year, because the milestones they should be meeting change as they get older, right? Because they're developmental milestones, right? So if you've got a group of kids that come in and, you know, 80% of the kids are on track at the beginning of the year in grade 2, and then you see that at the end of grade 2, now we only have 40% of kids that are on track, you can see that there's a problem in the system, right? Like that's not a problem with those kids. So the screening is really important for problem solving for the individual kids, but it's also really important for just problem solving at the school and the system level.
Have you thought a lot about what if you could totally reimagine the system so that it was less reliant solely on reading and writing comprehension? What could that potentially look like?
Well, I think the way that I reimagine the system is a system where we make sure that everybody can be successful with reading and writing comprehension, right? So there's a lot of data now to show that over 95% of people can be very successful with that if they receive the appropriate instruction at the right time. That at the right time piece is really important too. We've got to start when kids are young. So that's really the way that I reimagine the system, is that we're using evidence from, you know, the last 20, 30 years of science. There's been lots and lots of fantastic research done here in Canada and all around the world that could really have solved this problem ages ago if we just actually put the evidence into practice. So that's really how I envision things going forward.
Mm-hmm. What are the numbers? How common is it how many in 100 people are, I was going to say developing dyslexia, but you said it's hereditary. So I suppose developing is maybe not the right word to use, but what are the stats?
So the stats that we use at Dyslexia Canada are between 10 and 20%, which I recognize is a huge range. That's 100% different, right?
But it's reason, a lot no matter what.
It's a lot no matter what. Yeah. And the reason for that range, there's a couple of reasons. It is hereditary, yes, but it's also environmental. It's one of those things that there's a confluence of things that happen, right? Mm-hmm. So there are protective factors that can be in place for kids that can help kids who are at risk of dyslexia never end up meeting the diagnostic criteria. And that the biggest protective factor is instruction, right? It's instruction and early intervention. So if we are successful in catching the kids who are at risk for dyslexia in kindergarten, and we start to provide them with that early, early intervention, we should have a huge reduction in the number of kids who actually would meet the diagnostic criteria down the road. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't mean that their brains aren't organized the way they were when they were born. It just means they no longer meet the threshold.
I mean, that is a, that like, again, 10 is big and 20 is gigantic. I mean, that's, those are, no matter what way you cut it, that's, that is a large slice of the population that is not getting what they need to be successful in all of the things that we have come to establish as important in terms of like a communal societal contribution. That's really big.
What is the diagnostic criteria?
So it's okay. And again, there are different ways that people diagnose dyslexia. So the way that it is in the DSM is around specifically around difficulties with reading. So they use a bunch of psychometric testing, looking at reading ability, spelling ability, things like that. And it has to fall with below a certain threshold, right? There are other definitions that have that. And then they also look at a discrepancy with IQ. So they say that these difficulties with reading are unexpected because the person meets this threshold of having above average to above average intelligence. That second way of doing it is has been called into question as being accurate, like the IQ piece, right? So one of the things that in Ontario, the Human Rights Commission recommended was that we stop using this second layer, the IQ testing, because there's so many challenges with IQ testing itself in terms of, you know, cultural bias and IQ testing, that sort of thing. And it was also being used, that IQ discrepancy piece in education has actually been used to prevent some kids from getting intervention that need it, right? So it's like, we recognize that they are struggling with reading, but because they scored below, like 2 points below on this arbitrary IQ test, we're not going to help them because we don't think that they qualify legally as having a learning disability, which there's so many different problems with that, right? Mm-hmm. So the definition that we would go with is the one from the DSM, like the Diagnostic and Standards Manual that psychologists use. And that's really based around the difficulties with reading, writing, and spelling.
That's really interesting because I would have guessed that having the layer of the IQ test would help to identify people who you know, might not just meet the threshold of the DSM.
You should watch the video, the Veritasium video on IQ testing
and
the issues with it.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
quite vast.
When you bring that up, I understand that. Do you feel like, I mean, obviously there's always people being sort of falling through the cracks in any system. Is there a better way to do it, or do you think that there could be, yeah, do you think there could be a better way to do it?
Yeah, like the better way to do it really is to do it in a response to intervention model, right? Where you're starting with the screening very young, you're providing intervention, and then you're looking to see how are the kids responding, right? So that would help to determine like which kids are struggling because they really do have this neurologically based difference that's making it difficult for them to learn these things when they're being provided with the appropriate instruction and the appropriate and sufficient intervention versus the kids that are struggling because, you know, they came into school starting off further behind because they didn't have as many literacy experiences before, or maybe they've been absent from school or whatever it is, right? Like that's how you can tease out the difference too. And so that is different than waiting and relying on big, you know, send the person to a psychologist and spend thousands and thousands of dollars on doing these big assessments. So that's really, I think, the way that we should be moving to.
In terms of your experience going through high school, did you go to university afterwards?
I did for a period of time, but I actually dropped out because I, like you, could not keep up with the reading. Like, I could read, but I read so much more slowly. I actually improved my reading now, which is very, like, that's a whole other story. But when I was in university, I actually went to university in Halifax too. I went and I did King's Foundation Year program.
Nice. Not in journalism.
Not in journalism, but I did the Foundation Year program, and I only picked it because it had oral exams, right? Because I cannot write written exams. Like, I really struggled with that. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, like, there's so much reading in that program, right? So I started early. I got the reading list the year before and started, like, working through it. But I was just exhausted by the end of that, right? You know, just trying to keep up with all of that reading. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Taylor and I both, like, we didn't finish university, and I started and did 1 year. And as I mentioned, I really struggled with it. But I'm curious, like, obviously, you're the head of an organization now. You have to think strategically about things. I imagine that communication is a big part of your job. How have you managed to balance your dyslexia diagnosis with this sort of need to have to, you know, use reading and writing in your day-to-day work?
Sure. Well, I'm actually, like, I've always considered myself a fairly strong writer. Like, it does take me a bit longer than others, but like, oral communication has always been something that I've leaned heavily into, and I kind of write the way that I speak. So that's always been fine. This job, like, there's a lot of talking to people in this job of what I do. So I certainly do a lot of that, but I lean into things like Grammarly. Like I said at the beginning, like, I'm a huge fan of that. I also have a great team of people that I work with. So I always send things out to them to look over and provide feedback, that sort of thing. But I mean, I think the other thing is that, you know, abilities change over time. Like, and even as an adult, you can improve your reading ability. And that's something that happened for me completely accidentally, but it was probably the best thing that I ever did. When my son was born, like, I was really, really motivated to make sure that he didn't have the same challenges that I did. And the only thing that I knew as a parent, because the only thing they tell you as a parent is just read to your child a lot, right? It's a read to your children. So, okay, great. So I started reading to him, like, the day he was born in the hospital. And I read to him out loud for hours a day, like, when he was a toddler and an infant, and, you know, just kept reading to him and reading to him and reading to him. And the process of doing that, by the time he was about 3 years old, like, I actually started to notice huge improvements in my own reading speed. So there was, like, one thing that people had always told me that you should be able to do when you're reading is to, like, read ahead on the line so that you can, like, your eyes are reading ahead from what you're saying when you're speaking out loud, so that you can put the proper phrasing in place and, you know, commas and intonation and that sort of thing. I could never do that. Like, I could never even wrap my head around how people would even start to do that. But by the time he was three, I remember I was reading him a Magic Treehouse book, and I was, like, reading it, and it was, like, sounding like a normal person reading. I was just completely floored with myself. So afterwards, after I started getting into all the reading research, I found out, like, that reading out loud is the, you know, the best thing you can do to improve your reading fluency, especially repeated reading. So again, like, when you've got a little kids are always bringing you the same book over and over again, like, read me Curious George again, right? And so I was, like, giving myself a reading intervention without even knowing it, essentially, for, you know, for that period of time. That's just so reading funny. To him out loud. So that's really helped. Like, I don't know if I would have been able to keep up with the demands of this job 10 years ago. But that experience was really good. I also basically did all of the dyslexia intervention with my son when he was learning to read, right? So through that process, because of where we live in Tiny, a small town north of Toronto, where there are no tutors, actually called Tiny, I couldn't get a dyslexia therapist for him. So I had to learn how to do it myself. And through going through that process with him and doing it, I learned so much about how the English language works and how spelling works, all these things that for my life had been a complete mystery. And that was hugely helpful as well.
What are the conversations like with your son around dyslexia?
Oh, you know, it was a really interesting bonding experience for us, is what I'd say. Because like, I had not ever talked about my dyslexia until he was officially diagnosed, and I hadn't leaned into it at all. So the two of us definitely kind of went down the rabbit hole together. And that was nice. So we spent a lot of time reading about successful people who have dyslexia. I was like constantly sharing TED Talks with him and different profiles of people, that sort of thing. And then, you know, he came like along with me on this journey of discovering everything that I know now about, you know, how reading works and the science of reading and the disconnect between that and what's happening in the education system. You know, he was there at the launch of the Ontario Human Rights Commission's inquiry. He went and he spoke at Queen's Park, and he talked to our MPP all about the disconnect and really wow. What would have been more helpful for him. So, yeah, it really, though, made it very difficult for him for the rest of school, because he loved his teachers as human beings, but he lost all trust in them, right? Mm. When he realized how far removed what they were telling him was from what he actually needed, it got to the point where pretty much everything that came home, he would be asking me like, okay, do I do this? Like, is this a useful assignment that's going to help me learn? Or is this just complete and utter BS? You know, like, So I had to sort of talk him into doing different things. So it was challenging from that perspective, but he's in high school now and he's doing great. He just got his interim report card. He was like above 95 and everything. Like, he's a very wow. smart kid, but just the, you know, the insecurity and all of that, it took years, honestly, to kind of get him to the point where he was a confident kid again.
Speaking of the insecurity and like lack of confidence, one thing I like trying to put myself in the shoes of someone who has dyslexia, who is in school, you know, being called on to read a paragraph out loud or to have to do some sort of presentation that requires doing that in front of a class. Did you have experiences like that? And did you feel shame or lack confidence in doing that when you were called on in class?
Definitely when it came to having to read, like, I definitely have memories of having a book in front of me and like trying to count paragraphs because they're kind of going down the rows and like, okay, it's going to be this one. So I just spend the entire time reading it so that I could try and read it when it was my turn. So I'd have absolutely no idea what was going on with the rest of the reading. Right. Complete waste of time. So I do remember that and that sort of sinking sense of dread. When it came to presentations, though, like, I always loved giving presentations. I just never read for any of them, right? Like, I would just stand up and talk. And I was always happy to share what I knew orally, which is, I think, you know, I'm not going to generalize strengths of people, but there's lots of us with dyslexia who understand everything that's going on. We remember what we hear, and we can participate really well if we're giving those opportunities to do it orally. So I really do encourage teachers to, you know your students and have options for how you get to express your learning.
Did you ever share like strategies? I love a good hack. I'm wondering if you, when your son got his diagnosis and you sort of went down that journey together, did you share any like hacks with him? Did he tell you anything that he was doing in school that you were like, dang, that would have been really good to know back when I was in school?
I don't know about a hack specifically. Like, the one thing that we do really lean into, though, is audiobooks. And I wish that I had that option when I was in high school or in university, is like really listening to text instead of reading it, or listening to it while reading it and marking it up. So that's like my biggest learning hack, is that for me, like, even though I, you know, as I said, I can absolutely read now and I've even improved my reading speed, I still do better when I listen. I just do. And so, yeah, we try to get as much for him in audio as possible. And again, he can read now too. Like, he does read for pleasure. It's great, but he reads more slowly. And so, you know, if he's going to be able to keep up and not completely exhaust himself and also be able to do all of the other things that a teenager should be able to do, you know, leaning into audio, I think is a good thing.
Alicia, there's something that has really stood out to me in our conversation today, and it is it's a reminder of something that I already know, but something that I probably don't think about enough or think about consciously enough is, you know, I mentioned earlier in the show that reading and writing is something that has come very naturally to me over the years, and it's something that is a strong suit of mine. And you taught me so much about the process of learning to be able to do that can only come from the experience of somebody who struggled, and just like highlighting the importance of learning from people who have had a hard time at getting of learning something, because mm-hmm. there's so much wisdom in the struggle, and there's so much knowledge in that, that it just reminds me to try and keep learning from not from people who have just been able to do it, but people who have really had to put in, you know, the extra work. And not to say that we shouldn't put in a lot of support systems to make that as easy as possible, but even with those supports, it's going to be yeah. extra work no matter what, and that yields a lot of knowledge and wisdom. So I
just want to echo what Taylor's saying, because I know now that he will actually spend time with his daughter actually teaching her, rather than just having the expectation that she'll just be able to do it because it was easy for
him. I'll stop putting the book in front of her and going, why can't you do it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll because she is that. Only 1.5. Yeah. So,
which is no excuses, but
so hopefully we've learned at least a little bit of something today.
Right. Yep, that's it. thank you so much, Alicia. I do not have that expectation of my 1.5-year-old daughter. Thank you so much, Alicia, for joining us today. We had an awesome time learning about everything it is that you do at Dyslexia Canada, and your journey and your experience and the things that we can learn from and do better in education systems and in the workplace and stigma and all those things that we need to be thinking about. So thank you for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you for inviting me. It was a really great conversation.
That is it for this week's edition of Routine Checkup. Thank you so much for tuning in, folks. It means the world to us. And if you'd like to continue listening to the podcast, you can do that right here on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And of course, if you want to support the podcast further, you can leave us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts, or you can simply rate the podcast on your Spotify mobile app. And even better than that, why don't you tell someone that you know, tell someone that you love, tell someone that you don't know that you listen to Sick Boy Podcast and recommend it to them, because we always love those extra ears. The podcast is produced and hosted by myself, Jeremy Saunders, Brian Stever, and Taylor McGilvery. The podcast is managed by Jeffrey Lonis at Talent Bureau. The theme music for today's episode comes from Rich O'Coin. Thanks again, folks. Hope you enjoyed it, and we'll be back next week. That's it for now. My name is Jeremy, and this is Sick Boy.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.